Hello, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to the Weekend Sports Wrap Podcast. I'm your host, James Timberlake. Welcome to the show. It's good to be back. It's the week before Memorial Day weekend, so we're getting things out, and then we're taking a long weekend, which, praise thy Lord, I greatly, greatly love. There's nothing better than a nice three-day weekend. I mean, truly, I can count on one hand the number of things that I enjoy more than a three-day weekend. And I said count on one hand, but I don't have specifics off the top of my head. But three-day weekend would be up there. It is one of the best things. I love a three-day weekend. And we're approaching it. Memorial Day weekend coming up. I don't know how nice it's going to be. We'll see. But regardless, three-day weekend, doesn't even matter what I'm doing. We do have, it's a big week. We're going to talk sports, obviously, game sevens over the last few days, well, I guess yesterday, over the weekend between the Knicks, Pacers, and the Nuggets and the T-Wolves. We're going to talk a little bit about that, get into some conference final matchups and whatnot, and then maybe talk a little bit of baseball as well. Not positives for baseball, I'll be honest with you, because baseball has been a little bit slow for me. I haven't really gotten into the season, to be honest with you, a whole lot so far, and there's a kind of a reason for that. I'll get into that a little bit later. But we'll get into it. It's also a big week for movies. Got a big week for movies. It's Furiosa is coming out this week. The Mad Max prequel to Mad Max Fury Road follows Furiosa. If you haven't seen Fury Road, stop listening to the podcast right now. Just stop. Go watch Fury Road. It's one of the great action movies, maybe of all time, certainly of the 21st century. It's a tremendous film. George Miller directed it. George Miller has one of my favorite filmographies, I think, of all time for any director. I don't think he's ever really done any acting, like serious acting roles or anything like that. But he's been a director for a very long time. He kind of got his start with Mad Max. That was like his breakout movie. He invented the Mad Max franchise, the universe of Mad Max, made the first one in 1979, and then he made the sequel in 1981, and then 1985 came out with Beyond the Thunderdome, which was the third one. Probably the weakest one from what I understand. I haven't seen Beyond the Thunderdome. Made those three movies and kind of launched himself into, I don't know if that time he was necessarily superstardom, but it was definitely, I mean, it's a very well-respected trilogy. It's not one of the greatest trilogies of all time, but it invented a universe. And, you know, back then in the late 70s, that's nothing to really, you know, stick your nose up at, if you will. He had some other directorial stuff that he was doing after that. He did a movie called The Witches of Eastwick, which was with the famous actor who's in The Shining, whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head, Jack Nicholson. Bingo, found it out of there. He did that, directed another like romance movie called Lorenzo's Oil. And then one of my favorite things. So we go, if you've ever seen Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, pretty dark movies. The entire Mad Max movie or franchise, really out there, pretty dark. Like it's bleak. It's not for necessarily the faint of heart. It's a pretty dark universe that they're in. All the water's gone. You know, it's all desert, and the car is kind of seen as this, or the engine, I guess, it's kind of seen as this religious icon, if you will, that is put inside of vehicles that makes them power, and you can drive great lengths in this vehicle. And then after he was making Mad Max 2, and Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome, there's some time and space between these next two movies that I'm going to talk about. 1985 was Beyond the Thunderdome. He did some movies in between this. And then 2006 comes, and he releases a movie. Actually, let's go back a little bit. Actually, 1998. Let's go 1998. He releases a movie as a director, directed this film called Babe, Pig in the City. Made Babe, Pig in the City, and here's your IMDb description for it. Babe, fresh from his victory in the sheep herding contest, returns to the farmer Hoggett's farm. I can't remember. I've seen the first one. It's been a long time though. But after Farmer Hoggett is injured and unable to work, Babe has to go to the big city to save the farm. A George Miller directed movie, Babe, Pig in the City. That was in 1998. Came out with that. Didn't get resoundingly very good reviews, but, you know, it's a children's movie. Kind of just throw it on in the background. And then in 2006, the creme de la creme for this director, not really, actually, but one of the funniest things about this director, 2006, he releases Happy Feet, an animated movie about penguins who can dance who can sing and can dance. The big difference is that there's one penguin who can't sing and is really good at dancing, and he learns to find his way as being this lone lone penguin that can dance. That's Happy Feet. And then he made Happy Feet 2 in 2011, and that was the last time we saw him do an animated project. And I believe there was an interview that happened, I think 2011, when Happy Feet 2 was coming out, and he has one of my favorite quotes from it, where he said when Happy Feet 2 was coming out, he's being interviewed, and when asked if he had any plans for Happy Feet 3, George Miller said, quote, "If you were to put a gun to my head and said, you have to come up with a story for Happy Feet 3, I'd say shoot me," end quote. And that was it. That was the last Happy Feet movie that we got directed by George Miller. Can't remember if they made another Happy Feet movie or not, but that was at least the end. Happy Feet 2 was the last one that we got from George Miller. And then just a couple of years later in 2015, I believe it was 2015, 2016, something like that. I think it was 2015. We got one of the great action movies in the history of ever. One of the greatest action movies of all time in Mad Max Fury Road. 2015 is when that came out. And yeah, the rest is history. Now we get Furiosa, the Mad Max prequel to Mad Max Fury Road. And it's coming out to some pretty good reviews so far. So I'm excited to go see that. That was a long-winded way of me saying excited to go see Furiosa. It's a big weekend in movies. And add it to the list. Furiosa, George Miller, just, you know, he knows what he's doing. Hey, I'm always interested in these people that can create these massive universes kind of in their head. Mad Max, when the first one came out in 1979, I don't think he really had, the grand scale that he has now with these Mad Max movies, because they've really kind of taken on a version of themselves, if that makes sense, where the world is kind of ever expanding. There's a lot of interesting, side stuff. I think there's a comic. There's a bunch of comics, I think, for Mad Max that is taking on its own kind of direction with Max as a character. And I don't think, and anybody that's creating that sort of stuff, like George Lucas, when he created Star Wars, I don't think there's no way he could have foreseen what would have happened with the Star Wars universe in terms of the scale that he had created, or that would have been the beginning of his creation with Star Wars and where it's ended up here and now. But still, just to see that not only that his creation is still, going around from 1979 to 2024, however long that is, can't do the math off the top of my head, but the fact that he's still very much involved with it. George Lucas was involved with Star Wars for a pretty long time as well, even after the original trilogy. He came out with the prequel trilogy as well. But not only that, the fact that, however 30 years later, he's still making very good, very good movies for the Mad Max franchise is a testament to his ability. So I respect George Miller. I think he's very good at what he does. I really appreciate his ability to do live, non-CGI'd stunt work. I think that's kind of something that we don't see. It's kind of having a bounce back, obviously. And I'm not saying stunt work has ever gone away, obviously, or anything like that. But the art of being able to craft really good action and stunts and whatnot into your film instead of just replacing it with CGI is an art that I think is having a bounce back. But it really did kind of go away for a while, or was kind of put on the back burner for a while in Hollywood. And I think George Miller's ability to make it very good and still make it look, massive in scale and whatnot, while using real explosions and stuff like that and real action and whatnot, and not having it all CG'd, is something that I respect a lot about George Miller. So, Furiosa's coming out, so it's a big week in movies as well. I'm sorry, we went on about a 9-minute rant there about George Miller, but man, the jump from Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome, and then the 15 years after that, he makes Babe, Pig in the City, Happy Feet, then Happy Feet 2, back to back to back. And then he says, if you were to put a gun to my head, I would not be able to make Happy Feet 3. He would just rather be shot. That is just peak. It's awesome. It's hilarious. It's one of my favorite things about his filmography, and one of my favorite things about filmography in general. So you can just make one of these things. And I'm pretty sure, this might be going out there, to be honest with you, but I would be willing to venture a guess in saying that he made Happy Feet. I don't know if he really wanted to necessarily per se. I don't know if that's really out there or anything like that. But I would be willing to venture a guess that he made Happy Feet and Happy Feet 2, because animated movies always end up, not always, but a pretty large majority of animated movies end up selling pretty well because they're just directed towards kids and it doesn't really matter if they're good or not. And I'd be willing to venture a guess that he made those movies in order to fund the project that was Mad Max Fury Road, because Fury Road's going to cost a lot of money to make regardless. And he was like, I'm going to make these movies, this Happy Feet 2 movie, just live with it and get the influx of income that he would get that way so he could go on to make Mad Max Fury Road. I can't confirm or deny that. I'm recklessly speculating. No idea if that's true. But if that is what he did, you know what? Sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and do it. You just got to bite the bullet, make your Happy Feet 2 movie, and then he can go on and create, you know, a masterpiece in Mad Max Fury Road. And then Furiosa as well, even though I would say Furiosa was made off of the back of how successful Fury Road was. It wasn't really, you know, he didn't need to go and make another animated movie in between that in order to fund Furiosa. So, yeah, shout out George Miller, man. He's great. Awesome. Really good director. Love watching a lot of stuff he does. Very, very unique in the way he does things with his films. Hey, you guys want to talk about sports? Let's talk some sports. Let's talk some basketball. It was a big weekend in the association, obviously. Some big games in the NBA with the Pacers and the Knicks playing, and then the Wolves taking on the Nuggets. We'll start with the Knicks and the Indiana Pacers. The Indiana Pacers end the Knicks season after being down 3-2 in the series. They had game six, obviously, at home, and then went on to win game seven on the road in the Mecca, as they call it. And I want to start by saying this about this game. All I've heard for, I don't know, forever, basically since the dawn of time, is since basketball began being played in Madison Square Garden, is you don't want to have a Game 7 at the Garden. You never want to have a Game 7 at the Garden. The Mecca will win you one. The fans will be there. It's the loudest arena to play in, and it's one of the hardest, you know, stadiums, arenas to play in a big playoff game in the NBA. That might be true or whatever, but man, you can't be saying that and then give up 130 points in the Game 7 finale of the series. 130-109 was the final score. The Knicks get blown out, and it wasn't close basically throughout the game. The Knicks cut it down to 8, I believe, if I remember correctly, in the third quarter, about halfway. It was late third quarter. They cut it down to about 8, but then the Pacers went on another run and just shut things out. Pacers, I think for a lot of people that don't know this either, they had, which is insane to say, but in terms of offensive rating, and I think it was points per 100 possessions, they had like the best offense in the history of NBA basketball, which, you know, that's been a stat that's kind of been stacking on top of each other for the last few years just because of how potent three-point shooting has become in the NBA. So I think I don't think that's necessarily going to last. And I think some of the metrics probably need to change a little bit just in terms of how we value. And you know, it's already changed a lot in terms of how we value the three-pointer, but just in terms of how it shows up on a stat sheet and kind of how it compares in terms of potency to, you know, previous NBA teams and whatnot. And you know, I don't know if, and statistically saying the Pacers, obviously, according to what the NBA has put together in terms of stats, is one of the best, most potent offenses we've ever seen. But according to some of the stats, like the points per 100 possessions and whatnot, all of those stats would put them at one of the, if not the best offense in the history of the NBA. But in reality, if you were to put them up against, you know, the Warriors of the previous decade, I guess, I would pick the Warriors in this situation. I'm not picking the Tyrese-led, and this is no knock on Tyrese Halliburton. Obviously, he's a very good player, you know, not necessarily drug that team, but was the catalyst for that Game 7 win over the Knicks last night. But, you know, when we're talking about the teams that the Warriors were able to put together and whatnot, I would obviously be taking the Warriors in that situation without a doubt. But according to the stats, this Pacers team is a better offensive team than those Warriors teams of the past decade have ever had. So, you know, there's just kind of a weird way that we look at the stats when it comes to offensive potency and how good they are. And I don't doubt, obviously, this Pacers offense is still very good, but it just changes drastically depending on who they're playing and what they're playing, what type of offense they're playing and whatnot. So, I don't know. It's just kind of a weird way to show it. But then again, you see a Game 7 where they go to quote unquote, the Mecca at New York at Madison Square Garden. And again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm bashing just the Garden because, you know, there are other things at play here. The injuries were a big factor for the Knicks in that game. Jalen Brunson went down, I think it was early in the fourth quarter or late in the third quarter, if I remember correctly. And he fractured his hand. He wasn't able to play. But at that point, to be honest with you, that game was kind of out of reach regardless. In the Garden was jumping. Like, by all means, it was very, very loud, at least at the very beginning of the game. And then the Pacers kind of went on a run to, you know, late first quarter into the second quarter. It was, you know, the Pacers had full control of the game up until the late in the third quarter where the Knicks cut it down to about eight. And then again, the Pacers just rattled off a bunch. And that was basically it. I will say that I think the biggest issue that I've always had with Tom Thibodeau-led teams as well is this is kind of the problem you run into. It's either with Tom Thibodeau-led teams because he works those guys harder than any other NBA coach in the association, and it's not particularly close. You see the player-led surveys and whatnot that come out through The Athletic, the anonymous player surveys, and Tom Thibodeau, in terms of least wanting to, like, players rank their coaches that they least want to play for, they most want to play for. And Tom Thibodeau is consistently at the top of that list. And it's not because he has any personal issues with players or anything. It's because every practice he works them harder and harder and harder every single practice. And that grows old on a lot of people. And, you know, this Knicks team kind of leaned into that. They didn't have really, you know, as we were continuing on with the series, they seemingly didn't have any issues with it. But with time, like, your body can only handle so much. And for OG Anunoby and Dante DiVincenzo, he played as well. But Josh Hart, Jalen Brunson as well, there's a limit to where you could push these guys. And this has kind of been the problem, in my opinion, with the Tom Thibodeau-led teams, where they always end up just kind of breaking down because they seem, and they didn't seem exhausted or anything like that. The Knicks didn't, but I will say that, you know, the injuries, I don't want to pin them on Tom Thibodeau or the, you know, or anything like that, but there is something to be said about fatigue and, you know, injuries being piled on because of fatigue. And that is not something to, you know, to scoff at. I mean, Julius Randle was already lost through most of that season, and I think a lot of people forget that Julius Randle was part of that team. He was out for all of the playoffs, obviously, and the Knicks, honestly, were probably better off because of that, and if I'm being honest with you, I think they were a lot more open and free to kind of, or they let Jalen Brunson, it allowed Jalen Brunson to be a lot more open and free to kind of do whatever he wanted. There wasn't a lot of clogging of the lane or anything like that from, and Julius Randle's, you know, kind of a stretch four anyway, so he's not necessarily clogging the lane, but not necessarily. When you have a focal point like Jalen Brunson, there's no ifs, ands, or buts that he's the number one at that point. Then that leads to him being at his most effective. And that's what he was throughout the series, throughout the previous series. But there is something to be said about, and for the most part, I think, like, the Jalen Brunson fractured hand, that's just kind of a freak accident. But if it wasn't in this series, I think we would have began to see a lot more fatigue, especially this series going seven, fatigue against the Boston Celtics and that situation. So I just think Tom Thibodeau-led teams are not built. They're built to play very good defense against a lot of teams, obviously, but they're not built for long runs into the playoffs. We saw, you know, numerous Bulls teams get kind of shackled by injury. They'd run into, they'd have the best defense in the league heading into the playoffs, maybe a mediocre offense, and then get shut down by, you know, a LeBron-led Heat team, get beat in five or six games or whatever. Derrick Rose would go down with an injury, and Derrick Rose, we kind of just look at as an injury prone player throughout his career, but there's something to be said about the wear and tear that was maybe put on to him from Tom Thibodeau in his practice methods, in the way that they played the game through Derrick Rose and what he was asking of Derrick Rose on defense as well. I think there's something to be said about that sort of thing. And I think we're going to continue to see that out of New York because, you know, they can lean into that dog mentality or whatever, that blue collar work ethic, quote unquote, that they have. But at the end of the day, if your body's not able to keep up, if your body's going to break down, you're not going to be able to continue to do it. And as we saw the team kind of just fall apart through the series with the Pacers, and even beforehand in the series against the Sixers, you know, the team as a whole just kind of started falling apart and not playing well. You saw guys that were getting minutes in that game seven that were not typically getting minutes in the previous games in that series or in the series beforehand. And if you're Tom Thibodeau or Leon Rose, who is the director of player personnel, president of player personnel, whatever it is, you have to be, I think for the most part, you have to be able to put a very, very deep team around Tom Thibodeau so that he can do this in case there are injuries. You can slide in, you know, you're not going to slide in an ulcer or anything like that, but somebody who is very effective off the bench. And again, the Knicks didn't really have that. They didn't really have anybody that could go to. Again, Alec Burks is somebody that you can go to that, you know, can get you 20 any given night or whatever, but he can also give you, you know, 3-on-1-of-9 shooting or whatever as well. So I don't know. The Knicks are just confusing to me. And the Tom Thibodeau experience to me is also very confusing. I don't see a lot of situations in which I see Tom Thibodeau-led teams and I'm like, that's a team that can get to the NBA Finals. That's a team that's good enough, because there's always that air of like, you know, this team has been Josh Hart played like 48 minutes in most of these games. That's the entire game. Like in a lot of these games, he was playing 48 minutes. That can't last. Like that will not last going into, you know, the next series or the series after. Like it is a long road to be playing 48 minutes a night. And, you know, you kind of always wanted to believe in yourself and say, hey, I can do that. I'm better than people. I've got more heart than said people or whatever. But the body is just not made to do that, to go 48 minutes of back-breaking basketball, beat-down style of basketball, which is what they play because they're a very heavy defensive team where you're playing your heart out on each side of the ball. There is not a situation where that works out very often. And, you know, in the end, Josh Hart was the only one that felt like, and well, I think he actually did go down with an abdominal strain as well. But, and the other thing too, when we saw OG Anunoby after he came back, we saw him on the sideline talking to Leon Rose, and man, he looked like he was shot up with every drug that you can imagine under the sun. That dude looked like he had no idea where he was, and he played relatively well in that game against the Pacers as well. But he was coming off of injury. He probably should not have been playing in that game. But again, it's a winner takes all. It's a game seven. You don't leave any chess piece unused, if you will. And they put on Anunoby out there. We'll see how that ends up costing him in the future and whatnot. But he looked like he was wired in that video that we saw with him and Leon Rose. Like he had no idea where he was. But, you know, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about that in the NBA, obviously. That only happens in the NFL, okay? We don't talk about that in the NBA. But, yeah, this Knicks team, it'll be curious to see what they do moving forward. I think Hartenstein's going to be a free agent, and that guy's a fan favorite, obviously. I don't know how important he is in the long run. I think you might be able to find a duplicate Isaiah Hartenstein. Could be wrong about that, obviously. I think they're going to want to re-sign him. And a lot of your dog guys, or you're going to want to extend as well. But, you know, again, with Tom Thibodeau teams, I think it's how deep are you versus how good your starting rotation is, because your guys are probably going to get hurt. Like they're probably going to come into some sort of fatigue, hurt or whatever that cost them games or what have you. And I think you have to be able to have a bench that's good enough to be able to put up with that and then know that they're going to be stepping into some bigger shoes if there is some sort of injury that happens to a player that is in the starting rotation. But, you know, we'll see. And, you know, Pacers too. Pacers, very good basketball team. We talked about them. Offense, and it took, you know, an unbelievable shooting night. One of the best shooting nights in the history of game. I think it was the best shooting night in the history of game seven. They shot like 65% from the floor or something ridiculous like that. That's all it took. Be a very interesting series between them and the Celtics. I do think the Celtics are far and away the better team. They've been the best team this season, you know, far and away the best team this season in either conference. Basically none of the games that they've played have been close. They did lose one to the Cavs, but that one wasn't close either, where they got blown out by the Celtics got blown out by the Cavs, but then the Celtics just blew out the Cavs in four games as well. So it'll be interesting to see. I do think without Porzingis, which the Celtics will not have Porzingis, at least as of right now, heading into the series in this Eastern Conference Finals series, it will be interesting to see how they deal with the length that the Pacers do have with Miles Turner down low. Tyrese Haliburton is kind of a big guard as well. It'll be interesting to see how they kind of deal with that length without Porzingis down low, and if they're going to be playing a lot of small ball, which they're probably going to have to be. If there's one knock on this Boston Celtics team, it is that they are not very deep either. They do not go very deep into their bench, and they don't really have a big, and he's not in Porzingis isn't really a block guy or a big down low preventer down low or anything like that. But Al Horford definitely isn't. So now they really don't have that guy at all in Porzingis. If Porzingis is out, and it'll be interesting to see how they're able to stack up against a guy like Miles Turner and the length of Tyrese Halliburton as well, who is going down low and or stepping back and shooting a three with his weird release. But it'll be interesting. Be good Eastern Conference Finals. I think a lot of people were hoping for Boston, New York, which is understandable. You know, the history there, the rivalry there, just between the two cities would have been very interesting. But I do think that with the injuries that were stacking up for the Knicks, this is probably going to be the better series because there were a ton of injuries on the Knicks team. And especially if they were to come back after Jalen Brunson got hurt, there was no shot that the Knicks were going to be able to win that series if Brunson was not going to be able to play against the Celtics. Just no chance, absolutely no shot. So I do think that we, in the end, got a series that's going to end up probably being a little bit better, even though I do think the Celtics are probably going to win the series in five or six games because they are just that much better than the Pacers. But, you know, it's Rick Carlisle as well for the Pacers, a very good head coach, maybe an underrated head coach at this point because he was a champion, a coach of the year pretty much year in, year out. Granted, his Mavericks, who he were fired from, are playing at basically their best level since he was fired. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see between the Pacers and the Celtics.
Hi, it's Kathleen and Jack from 307 Real Estate.
If you're thinking of buying a property in the near future, the first thing you should do is call your banker or a home loan company and get pre-qualified. That way, you'll know in advance how much you can borrow for your dream home.
Great advice, Kathleen. There's nothing worse than finding that perfect home and then finding out you don't qualify. Once qualified, give us a call and we can start looking for that perfect home.
We're a Wyoming-based company and here for you, Wyoming.
Call Kathleen and Jack at 307 Real Estate, 307-763-1249. You're in heaven living in 307.
Now, the Denver Nuggets, Minnesota Timberwolves, that one went seven as well. Timberwolves winning that series in seven games. Similar situation. The Wolves were down 3-2 heading into game six. The Wolves just stomped the Nuggets in game six and then come back from 20 points down to win game seven as well. For the Nuggets, we're going to hear a lot about how the Nuggets kind of... they did blow it. They had 20-point lead. It was a 3-2 series heading into Game 6 where they just got blown out in Game 6. They had a 20-point lead in Game 7. They should have won that game. They had Minnesota in a spot where they exactly where they wanted him because Minnesota is not a very good offensive team in terms of a lot of the team statistics. So they had Minnesota right where they would have wanted them, and then they just end up letting it go, essentially blowing it in the second half of that game, blowing it to Cat. Cat had a very good game. Anthony Edwards had, for the most part, a pretty good series, but he was not very good in the game seven. Rudy Gobert had a pretty good game as well. So just in the end, just kind of blowing it to that team because they should have won that series as well. But let's not get it twisted, okay? The Nuggets team that we saw this year is not as good, in my opinion, or was as good as the team from last year. They were noticeably weaker in terms of depth. They had a couple of guys that were coming back from last year's team, like Reggie Jackson, that was given a lot more increased minutes. But Jackson was not really able to replicate what, like, Bruce Brown was able to bring off of the bench. They really just were not able to match that sort of production whenever the Timberwolves were able to sub in different guys off of their bench. They're a little bit deeper on their bench, and that ended up kind of costing the Nuggets. I also think something that's maybe a little bit bypassed as well is they match up the Timberwolves match up with this Nuggets team very, very well. Rudy Gobert is somebody who I thought was going to get played off of the court because of I thought that that Nikola Jokic was going to be able to run a ton of pick and rolls and get Rudy Gobert switched onto situations where he didn't want to be against Jamal Murray or whatever. But the team defense that the Timberwolves were able to put together, basically anchoring Rudy Gobert down into the paint and not allowing him to get tripped up out into the open towards the top of the arc, was very impressive. I really thought coming into the series that the Nuggets were going to be able to pick apart this Timberwolves defense, especially in Rudy Gobert, because we've seen it time and time again from Rudy Gobert where he's just been caught out in the open and pick and rolls and in giant mismatches that put him in very bad situations. And in those situations, other people have had to come and help, and that leaves people open and whatnot. And it just ended up kind of becoming, you know, a merry-go-round where we've seen it every season, where he wins the DPOY, the Defensive Player of the Year, comes into the series, into some sort of opening series or the second series or whatever. And he's essentially played off the court. Hasn't been that bad with the Timberwolves, but we've seen it a time and time again with the Jazz and whatnot. And with the Timberwolves, he's definitely started to find his stride a little bit more when it comes to playoff basketball. And the team defense is kind of built around him. And not to mention, the Timberwolves, they got dogs. They got dogs on their team. Jaden McDaniels is probably, if not the best defensive guard in the game right now, one of the best defensive guards in the game. He can cover, it feels like, anybody 1 through 4, but he's very, very effective out on the arc. Just, he can cover pretty much anybody. He's locked down Jamal Murray, as well as Anthony Edwards locked down Jamal Murray in this series. Really, Jamal could not really get anything going. He only shot 40% in this series as a whole. And that was a big factor, basically having Nikola Jokic rolling the ball out there and saying, Nikola, you can score all you want. You can score from wherever. What, you know, that doesn't matter to us. And then not only that as well, but also putting him in these situations where Nikola Jokic does this thing where there are times where it is questioned whether he needs to be a scorer or needs to be a facilitator. And basically, it seemed like in this series, the Timberwolves were like, we're going to let you be the scorer all you want. We want you to shoot. We want you to score the points because you're not going to be able to beat us by yourself. And they locked down everybody else. And that was kind of the game plan. It ended up working for the Timberwolves. And it ended up being sparked. I also noticed in this game as well, especially in this game 7, in the latter part of the series, Nikola Jokic really, really, especially in game 7, really looked gassed. I mean, he was exhausted in game 7. He did not look like himself. He looked like he was really out of it and not himself in that 7th game. And, you know, I think that's kind of something you expect from Jokic, to be honest with you. You kind of have to roll with that because of what you're also getting on the court. But man, once they hit that second half, and even in the first half a little bit, Jokic looked like he was gassed. I mean, he was exhausted in that game, and I think that ended up hurting them as well. He only ended up shooting like 25%, not to mention 25% from three as well, which, you know, he's not a prolific three-point scorer or anything like that, but he, you know, when needed, he can spot up and shoot a three every now and again as well. And he shot like 46% through the playoff run last season when he went to the NBA Finals and won the championship. So that was also a pretty key difference. But man, this Timberwolves team, they're young, they're hungry. Anthony Edwards is, it seems like every single year we get a new player that's bursting onto the scene as the new guy, the playoffs guy, or whatever, the guy that's going to be the superstar heading into next season. And Anthony Edwards always kind of was a superstar, a budding superstar, if you will. But I mean, he has announced himself now into heading into the Western Conference Finals. He's here. And there's something to be said about them being able to match up with this Nuggets team and kind of limiting. And we come into a lot of these series with the Nuggets, and it's like, how do you even stop Nikola Jokic? And I think the Timberwolves saw, and they're like, maybe we don't even need to stop him. We just need to limit his ability at doing one thing, essentially being good at one thing. And that is, especially on the offensive side of the ball, scoring the basketball. Allow him to score the basketball. Don't let him be the lead facilitator. You know, guard a lot of these guys up the court, towards the full court, press them essentially and get Nikola Jokic the ball late in the shot clock. So he doesn't have they can't really run their offense as effectively late in the shot clock. And you're just having Nikola Jokic kind of make and pick decisions off of his own ideas or whatever, shoot the ball. And it ended up working. It was a smart play by them and a smart job by the Timberwolves. And they go on, they move on to the Western Conference Finals, take on the Dallas Mavericks. I will say that, after everything I just said about Rudy Gobert, the team that I think, maybe not the team, but a team that I think will be able to exploit the abilities of Rudy Gobert will be this Mavericks team, because they have two very, very good guards on their team. And if they're able to get a pick and roll game going like they did against Oklahoma City with Derrick Jones Jr. and PJ Washington, who was just sitting in the corner that entire series and hitting open threes. If they're able to do that, I think this could be a very interesting series against the Timberwolves, where the Mavericks might be able to work very well against this Rudy Gobert-led defense. And if they're able to find a way to kind of screen out Rudy Gobert in a bunch of different situations and kind of get him out of the play and put, or Luka Doncic on Rudy Gobert or something like that, or Kyrie Irving of Paul. I mean, if they're having situations where they're getting screen roles and they have Kyrie Irving or Rudy Gobert on Kyrie Irving and Rudy Gobert is playing defense against Kyrie Irving toward the top of the key. I mean, if we see a lot of that, the series is over. There's no shot Rudy Gobert is going to be able to defend the likes of Kyrie Irving at the top of the key, and even Luka Doncic as well, but mainly Kyrie Irving. Like, he's going to be the key to this series. If Kyrie Irving can find a way to get himself matched up with a lot of these bigs, because they like, the Timberwolves love to play big. They love to have Kat on the floor. They love to have Rudy Gobert on the floor at the same time. And if he can get one of those bigs on him during the course of the series on offense, that could be a game changer for this Mavericks team. So I do think that this Mavericks team does match up well with this Timberwolves team because of how long and how big this Timberwolves team is. The speed that Kyrie Irving and that offense likes to play at in terms of their ability to ball handle and whatnot, whether it be Luka or whether it be Kyrie, is going to play a big role in this series. And I think Kyrie is going to end up being the key. If the Mavericks want to win this series, I think having Kyrie, not necessarily as your primary ball defender, but maybe as the screen and roll hunter, if you will, against this Timberwolves team, I think that will be the key to this series. In the end, though, I don't know. I still like the Timberwolves because I think Anthony Edwards is a dog. I don't think they have anybody on the Mavericks that will be able to match up against Anthony Edwards either, at least effectively. So I think that will be a big situation, which Anthony Edwards can really eat and do a lot of good work down low. Also, I mean, that's the other thing too. If you look at the opposite, Derek Jones Jr. Is a decent defensive presence, but I don't know if he's really matched up with anybody the likes of Kat yet, especially not in this playoff run yet. So that'll be an interesting matchup as well. And we'll see if Kat is able to kind of hunt those situations down against Derek Jones Jr. or somebody that's smaller as well on the offensive side. So it's going to be a good series. I think this is going to be a very good series as well. Two good matchups and healthy teams as well, which is all you can ever ask for. We'll see what happens. What happens in the series, Western Conference Finals, Eastern Conference Finals. It's going to be fun. I'm excited. We're going to see two or four, a new champion at least, because the Nuggets got knocked out, but also at least somebody that will be able to kind of launch their quote-unquote legacy with a championship this year, whether it be Ant, whether it be Luka, whether it be Tyrese Halliburton, or whether it be Jason Tatum as well. And I think right now, as I'm, you know, seeing the outside looking in, it should be the Celtics. Celtics have been the best team. They've been blowing everybody out. They've only lost, I think, twice in these playoffs so far. Both of those games were blowouts. And that's the big thing about the Celtics that I think people are maybe a little hesitant on, is they have not played a lot of close games. And when they do play in close games, they kind of turn into a shell of themselves. So if they're put into close game situations, are they going to be able to kind of break out of that shell, end up playing the good offense that they've been able? Because when they get into close games, they love to play a lot of hero ball through Jason Tatum, through Jaylen Brown. And a lot of that ends up just kind of being like step back threes that don't end up hitting. And if you're a defense and allowing just a step back three from Jason Tatum late in the game, that's a win. Whether go in or not, that's a win. You'll take that where they're not able to get into their offensive production in a lot of their offensive schemes. That will be a win for them. So it'll be interesting for the Celtics. I think that's like the big hindrance that they've had on their resume so far, is they do struggle at times in close games. You know, with 5 minutes left, their offense really just slows down to a halt, and it's not nearly as effective as it is in the previous, you know, 43 minutes of the ball game. So that'll be interesting. Legacies, the launching of legacies on the line. We'll see who comes out victorious in the Western Conference, Eastern Conference Finals. I'm excited for those. Let's talk a little bit about some baseball really quickly. I want to talk mainly, not necessarily anything specific, to be honest with you. But the problem I have with baseball right now, and this is kind of what it's going to be, there's not a lot that I have been very interested in when it comes to baseball. The only thing that I've really been blown away about story-wise and this is not a good thing, has been a lot of the Shohei stuff in terms of gambling allegations and whatnot. I don't think he's really done anything. But now we have another thing with David Fletcher, who used to be the second baseman for the Shohei Ohtani-led Angels. And he was playing as recently as like 2-3 years ago there, I remember, if I remember correctly. And now there's an investigation ongoing whether David Fletcher was gambling in those games. And there has been a report that's come down that he was gambling, taking, you know, Shohei bets and whatnot, using the same bookie that Shohei's interpreter was using during those times as well. And that has been largely the biggest story in baseball, both Shohei and now with David Fletcher coming on board and being one of those people that were gambling, at least during the season, as it seems so far, allegedly, as it seems so far, on betting on Shohei and whatnot, betting, using, or not using anything, but betting on Shohei overs or whatever, or betting on the Angels or whatever. That's seemingly where we're at right now. And that is not a good sign for baseball. And not to mention, baseball, for me anyways, baseball is hard for me to watch when my team is not just very good. And my team, I'm a Red Sox fan, and my team is very, very middle of the road right now. They have good pitching staff, but their offense hasn't been stellar by any means. And they're very much a very middle of the road baseball team. And that is not very fun to watch, especially when you know you have 162 games or whatever to kind of go through in the season. And when the division around you is playing at a much higher level, the Orioles are very good. The Yankees are obviously very good. The Blue Jays are the Blue Jays, and the Rays are probably as bad as they've been in 5 years. But, you know, when they're like the 500 team, the mediocre version of baseball is like the worst version of baseball to watch, because you don't really have a chance to win anything, it feels like. And it's also like you don't have a lot of draft capital because you're going to be, you know, a middle round pick or whatever. And you can't trade picks or anything like that in the MLB. For the MLB draft, you can trade prospects and stuff, but you can't trade picks or anything like that. So that's kind of like the worst position to be in. And it just makes it kind of hard to watch because you don't have a lot of future or a lot of hope for the future per se, because you're not seeing a lot of like young guys come up and play in the team. You're not really, there's not really an appointment viewing for any particular prospect that's coming up to play or anything like that. And that just doesn't happen. And there's no real championship aspirations either for the team that's being put on the field. And that kind of goes for a lot of different teams as well, you know, that are just kind of mediocre, you know, minus the, you know, like the Rockies. The Rockies have been bad forever, it feels like, and the A's, who have been bad forever. There's always just kind of some middling, mediocre teams that are consistently not great. Like the Twins are a good example. They've been not stellar over the last few years, but they've been good enough to like make the playoffs, but then they lose in like the in the divisional round or whatever. And then that's the season. And that's gotta be like, that's gotta be torture. Like, I can't imagine being somebody like a Twins fan and just seeing that year in, year out. It's happened more recently than anything. They used to not be very good at all. But within the last 4 or 5 years, they've been good enough to make like a wild card, get into the wild card, lose the wild card, come back again. Don't spend a whole lot of money or cash to try to get anybody like superstar wise into the team. And then they'll go out, do the same thing, go, you know, like 90 and whatever. 90 is usually a pretty good year. So, but they'll go like 87 and 74 or something like that. And, you know, maybe win the wild card that year and then head into the division round and then lose in three or something like that. And that's got to be, that's just got to be torture. I cannot imagine doing that year in, year out over and over and over again. Like, that's got to suck. I feel bad for, and I'm picking on the Twins in specific, but there's a couple teams that are kind of like that. Like, the Brewers are another example. They've gotten a little better over the past few years. They've been very good with their pitching staff and whatnot, but it's been a lot of the same where they've gotten, you know, they've won a division or whatever. I think they won a division last year as well. But then they get into the championship series or the DS, and then they lose in five, or they lose in, you know, in six games or whatever. Or another example would be the Giants. Well, actually, that's a bad example because they were probably one of the best franchises in the previous decade, in the 2010s. So maybe a better example would be like the Cardinals in the last 10 years, I would say, post like David Freeze run or whatever. They've kind of just been a team that's had, you know, some seemingly budding talent, and then they either trade it away, they end up going, you know, 87, 88 wins or whatever, get into the playoffs, and then don't do anything in the playoffs. They have seemingly what should be a good roster this year, but their pitching's not very good. They have Nolan Arenado at third base, Paul Goldschmidt, two very good players, but they're not good enough pitching-wise. And again, it's probably going to be another mediocre year in a pretty solid NL Central season, or NL Central. And then they're going to lose out in the playoffs. They make the wild card or something, and then they're just going to lose out in the playoffs and kind of do it all over again. It's frustrating. It's not fun to watch. It just feels like you're doing, it's the definition of insanity where you're just doing the same thing over and over again and expect different results. But now with the biggest story, add that onto the fact that the biggest story in the MLB right now is the gambling accusations against Shohei Ohtani, as well as now David Fletcher, who was a teammate of Shohei Ohtani's, who was using the same bookie as Shohei's interpreter. Not great. Not great. Not a great situation with that being your biggest story on the season so far. Nobody's going to talk about it in the MLB, obviously, or MLB Network or whatever, because, you know, they're not going to bring to light that entire situation until there are results on investigations and whatnot. But that being just and that left into the ether, if you will, where that's being the biggest conversation piece. And now, you know, minds are just running wild with it. It's not great. It's not a great situation to be in if you're the MLB. It's not a great situation to be in if you're a fan. And then add that onto the fact that your team is just not very good or it's mediocre. And you're having to watch the Dodgers again spend $1.4 billion in the offseason. And they're going to be very good. They always are very good. Same thing with the Yankees. It feels like it can get old. And I understand that. I understand that. And especially when you have to do it for 162 games, we're in May and there's still 4 months left in the season or whatever, 3 months left in the season. And it's like, man, we have to go through all this still. We still have to go through all this. We're not going to win anything here. There's no way. That's tough. That's tough. That's not great. Here, I'll be the first to say it. And I'm not the first to say it. I don't know why I said that. Gotta shorten the MLB season. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I'll say it, all right? And I think we'd probably get more approval from the MLB players than you would think. I think we would get more approval from MLB players than you'd think on shortening the MLB season. I think we'd probably, I've talked about this before on the podcast, shorten it by a month, have the playoffs happen in September, and then the last game of, you know, the World Series, which is usually in November, like the last two games or whatever in November, have the last few games end up being in October. And there you go. You can still call it your Fall Classic or whatever. But yeah, anyways, just ranting about the MLB. Not a lot of stuff that I've found very interesting other than a lot of the stuff with Shohei and then now David Fletcher put that on top of it. The fact that they were connected at the same time when David Fletcher was seemingly, allegedly gambling as well. Not great. Not a great discovery to be made if you are on. And I don't think I'm one of the people that's in Shohei's side. I don't think Shohei was gambling. I just think it's a bad situation with his interpreter who was very clearly stealing money from him and using it to sustain his gambling addiction, essentially. But the fact that you had somebody connected to the team that he was playing on at the same time, seemingly gamble at the same time, is not great. It's not a good sign. Not a good sign. But anyways, that's going to wrap it up, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you very much for tuning in. Appreciate it very much. We'll be back here pretty soon. We've got Memorial Day weekend coming up. I hope you guys have a very good, if you do, hope you have a very good 3-day weekend. And we'll be back here pretty soon. So we appreciate it very much. We'll see you later. And we're out.